This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. March Madness coming up this week. I bet if you fill out an NCAA tournament bracket, you will not give much thought to the 14, 15, and 16 seeds or to the little-known conferences from which they come. This is a story about a guy who cared a lot about one of those small conferences, the America East. Only a Game's Martin Kessler has the story.
I was a really nervous kid.
Sam Perkins is now 32. He's a friendly guy who's known for occasionally telling long stories. But back when he was young,
I had a lot of anxiety around bad things happening to my parents, but especially my dad, which is crazy. I used to want to go with him to the store because I thought I'd protect him. I was this really little kid, and my dad was this massive human being. So I don't know what I thought I was going to do. And I would always ask my dad for reassurances, like, you're always going to be here. And he wasn't going to raise me like that. He said, no, there's going to be a time when I'm not going to be around anymore. You know, that's just how it is. But I'll always be with you. And I really didn't realize what that meant at the time.
Sam's father, Jack, played college basketball at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst during the 60s. He was a 6'6" forward. Sam didn't inherit his father's height, but he did develop a love for basketball. When Sam and his younger brother were little, Jack would drive them 2 hours from Boston to Amherst to catch UMass games. Back in the 90s, when John Calipari was coach, UMass was one of the best teams in the country. Sam's dad also introduced Sam and his brother to a much lower level of college basketball. The America East Conference is Division I, but it's a far cry from big-time leagues like the Big East or ACC. In 2002, when Sam was 17, Jack bought tickets to the America East Conference tournament. It was being held that year at Northeastern's Matthews Arena in Boston.
And I remember that weekend, Saturday and Sunday, it was unseasonably warm. It was 60 degrees the first weekend in March. It was raining. You walk into the lobby at Matthews, and it feels like going to a venue from the 1920s. And then you step into the arena, and the walls are gray. You've got the beams coming down, and the iron girders, and the pillars, and the rafters, and the roof, the wooden roof. You could hear the sound of rain, rat-a-tat-tatting off it, and Matthews was leaking. There was water running everywhere in there. It so added to the atmosphere of desperation that these kids had of trying to get to the big dance, and only one team is making it through. Only one team. And you know they're going to be a low seed and they're going to get blown out. But there was just amazing basketball and amazing storylines, and I fell in love with it.
Sam can still remember watching the Hartford Hawks and the Stony Brook Sea Wolves and the Maine Black Bears with his dad.
He was a guy who just sat back and took it all in and would talk to me during the games and about players that he respected or things that were going on the court. I feel like at that tournament, I was able to stop and take in the moment a little bit. I'm glad I did, because it was one of the last things that I ever got to do with my dad, that tournament and then the following year's tournament. And then he was riding his bike in from so he worked at the USDOT, and November 17th, 2003, he was riding his bike into work. He got hit by a van. That was going pretty fast, and he suffered a traumatic brain injury. He had a heavy bleeding in the brain. He shouldn't have survived, but he survived for another month and a half. He passed away on January 4th.
When his father died, Sam was 19 years old.
Didn't know what to do. I had been a good baseball player, And after my dad died, baseball, I hated it because I never noticed his absence more than when I was playing baseball. But during that time, I kept going to the America East games, and that was where I felt the closest to him. I would think about what he would be saying during these games or what he would be doing. I'd look over my shoulder and he wouldn't be there, but I could imagine these conversations with him that we'd be having, and just something about that felt like I was close to him.
Sam went to UMass Boston, a Division III school, but he kept attending America East games. He followed the conference in 2004, and then again in 2005, and again in 2006. In 2007, he graduated.
I didn't know what I was going to do with the rest of my life. I had a degree in English, you know, from undergrad. What am I going to do with that? I don't know. But I kept going to these games, so I started writing, and I started badgering people, publications, online sites, like, hey, can I write about the America East? You don't even pay me anything.
Editors started taking Sam up on his offer. For the next couple years, Sam traveled to games that no one else wanted to cover. Sometimes Sam's friends would go with him. They'd all pile into a hotel room and then go to games.
I'd be with my press pass covering it on Press Row, and they'd be heckling me from the seats and just insulting me, and it was really great.
Sam found he liked writing about basketball, but he really loved writing feature stories about these America East players.
It's different at the America East level. I don't mean to sound corny, but it is. It is different than big-time college basketball. These are not kids that are going to be famous. And I started thinking, like, these kids that leave everything and give everything, and it means so much to all their careers kind of amount to is being echoes in an empty arena. Well, maybe I could do something about that, and I could change that, and I could write about them, and then there would be something out there that said, like, hey, these people, they existed, and this is what they did.
So in 2010, Sam and his friend Matt Whitrock decided to create their own website. It would be called One Bid Wonders, and it would be devoted to covering America East basketball games and telling stories about players from the conference. At first, Sam says the site's only reader was his own mom. But then the website gained a following.
Then viewership started growing, and I was thinking, you know, hey, maybe I could become the next, I don't know, Bob Ryan, or the next, maybe I could become the next John Feinstein or something that I love writing about college ball.
Sam went to grad school to get a journalism degree and worked odd jobs to make money, but he kept pouring time into the website. And eventually, Sam did get opportunities to become a full-time sports writer.
But becoming a sports writer would have meant leaving the America East behind. And I realized that's not what I wanted to do, that the America East was why I was writing. That's what I loved writing about.
So after grad school, Sam took a full-time job as the editor of a small-town paper, and he stayed focused on getting more readers for his website, One Bid Wonders. And Sam gave writing opportunities to young kids who also wanted to write about low-profile college basketball conferences in the Northeast.
We picked up a kid named Doric Sam, who was a student at Stony Brook, and he started covering Long Island stuff for us. And then we added a young kid who grew up in the same city as me, was a lot younger than me, named Martin Kessler. You know, maybe that rings a bell.
Yep, that's me. After I graduated from college in 2013, Sam let me write for One Bid Wonders. I remember talking to Sam at games and hearing about his crazy travel plans.
I was going to 3, 4, 5 games a week, you know, all over the place. Not just in this area, man. Like, I was putting miles on my car.
So I just want to, like, you would be working a day job, but then you would still drive from, like, Boston to...
to Burlington or Orono or Vestal, New York or Long Island, yeah.
And then come back.
And then come back and work the next morning, yeah. Yeah, it was crazy, going on, like, 2 or 3 hours of sleep.
Sam says he wore out 5 cars traveling to games. At the time, it seemed to me like Sam just loved what he was doing, and everyone seemed to love Sam. During the 2013-14 season, Sam put up a donation page on the One Bid Wonders website so that readers could support his travel costs. $5,000 came in. In that next summer, Sam met 2 business guys at a wedding and started talking to them about investing in the website. Then in October 2014, I got an email from Sam. The subject line, "We are funded." I printed an email that she sent me.
Oh, God.
I'm hoping you could read it.
So, hey, Martin, OBW is going to be officially funded. Just had 2 investors buy in as partners with me, enough to fund the site completely for all this season so that I can quit my job and do it full time. Really exciting stuff.
Now, Sam could focus entirely on running One Bid Wonders.
I got pretty emotional to think that some other people believed in my crazy idea, and that was a really amazing feeling, to feel like, hey, this hasn't been for nothing.
Then the season began.
I was writing every single day like a maniac, and I didn't feel the same anymore. And I was just living in libraries and coffee shops, just churning stuff out, writing, you know, 35 features in the month of January and not sleeping. And I was just like, this isn't fun.
Sam's hair started falling out, something that hadn't happened to him since his father's death.
And then every game I would go to, I didn't feel my dad's presence as much anymore. I realized that I had been chasing my dad's ghost through these arenas and gyms and along these back roads and these, you know, nowhere towns for, you know, 12 years, 13 years, and it just was never going to catch him. And I kind of needed to move on.
After that season, Sam decided to shut down One Bid Wonders.
I wondered for a little bit, did I make a difference to anyone? Was it worthwhile? What was the point? Did I just waste this amount of my time?
But soon he learned he had made a difference. Sam started getting texts and calls from former players and coaches and fans saying how much the website had meant to them. Now Sam works as a special ed teacher with elementary and middle school students. He doesn't watch much college basketball anymore.
And I'm really happy with what I'm doing now, but I wouldn't be where I'm at if I had not covered the league the way that I did.
And now, Sam is a dad. 7 months ago, he and his wife had a son. He's named Jack, after Sam's dad. And since Sam doesn't go to many basketball games now, he's found a new time when he feels his dad's presence.
When I'm with my son, yeah. I think about my earliest memories are around him. You know, he would take me for walks in the carrier and just talk to me about stuff. I feel my dad when I'm with my son. It's really powerful. I don't know how else to describe it other than that. More than anything, I hope that I can duplicate just a little bit of the experiences my dad gave to me and the connections he gave to me through something with my son. You know, if I can be, you know, 1/10 of the dad that my dad was, I'll be real happy and I'll have done a good job.
That's Sam Perkins speaking with Only a Game's Martin Kessler. When Ira Brown was a kid growing up in Texas, he really looked forward to visiting his math tutor every week.
And like he had this really huge ring on his hand, and it was like a championship ring of some sort. I don't really remember the exact.
Brown's journey to 3 championship rings and a life playing basketball in Japan coming up on Only a Game from NPR. I'd like to thank Brave Cowboy Bill 75 for this review on iTunes. I hear something interesting each week and usually a side of sports I didn't expect. Personal and interesting and sometimes inspiring. Thank you. Thank you, Brave Cowboy Bill 75. Wonder if he's any relation to Clint Eastwood's Bronco Billy. Anyway, consider visiting iTunes and leaving a review of your own. It's the best way to help other listeners find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield. We've got a bunch of stories in this week's show about lesser-known basketball leagues and players, but I promise there will be none of that in this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know, unless, of course, my guests surprise me. They are WBUR Shira Springer and Michael Lee of Yahoo Sports. Welcome back to both of you.
Hello.
Hey, what's going on?
Shira, you're first.
Earlier this week, Nike announced that it will start selling a pro hijab for female Muslim athletes. The religious headgear has been tested by elite female competitors in the United Arab Emirates and Egypt, and it will go on sale in 2018. Now, the pro hijab makes a really powerful symbolic statement. After all, here's the biggest athletic brand in the world saying, essentially, global sports should be more inclusive for women. But let's be honest, part of Nike's motivation is market expansion. Perhaps it's not surprising that the hijab announcement followed Nike's release of an Arabic version of its training app. I get it, but wouldn't it be great if Nike offered more than the pro hijab and an Arabic training app? With its estimated worth of $27 billion, I'm thinking maybe Nike could fund gyms or training facilities for all the women in the Arab world who they hope will soon be wearing their hijabs.
I also would be much more inclined to applaud Nike if there wasn't a big swoosh on the side of, the, of that black hijab. Mm-hmm. It can't help but be a marketing technique if Nike is involved. That's what they're all about. And, hey, if it helps some athletes to be more comfortable and to be able to participate when they were not previously able to do that, good. But, boy, I would like to see one without the great big advertising logo on the side.
Well, I think it might actually help them make it look a little cool, too, because I remember covering a Muslim high school where the girls' basketball players just kind of just wore sweats, and it didn't actually look like the coolest, you know, look when everyone showed up on the court. So I think if you can come up with equipment that looks smooth, the swoosh is a brand that everyone, you know, kind of latches on to, I think in some ways it sort of lets you know I'm an athlete when you put it on.
I think that's a good point, but I think it could be just a bit smaller.
Probably.
It more is subtle. Quite in your face on the hijab.
Michael, you're next. What's on your mind?
Well, the NCAA tournament is just around the corner. And the biggest name, the name that everyone will probably be hearing a lot about, doesn't play, doesn't coach, but he is the father of one of the top players, and that's LaVar Ball. On the Mount Rushmore of athlete parents, you would have to put Earl Woods, Richard Williams, probably Mike Agassi, Marv Marinovich, you know, guys that are just so involved with their children's athletic success. And LaVar is actually taking it to the next level. He has three sons, Lonzo Ball, who is considered a top five prospect in the NBA draft, a point guard at UCLA. He's got two other sons who are in high school, LiAngelo and LaMelo. LiAngelo had 72 points in a game. LaMelo just had a game with 92. They're all about the numbers. They're all about the flash. But this dad is not just a man with a plan. He's a man with a big mouth. And if you put a mic in his face, he has a lot to say. And recently, he really shook up everything when he said that his son Lonzo is better than the two-time MVP Steph Curry. The Ball brothers have a chance to be something like the brothers Mannings of the NBA or something even bigger. But I wonder if the parent does too much to overshadow their kids, is that actually good or bad long-term for these guys?
Shira, there's a softball for you. Can there be a situation where the parent does too much for their kid?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. Parents can overshadow their kids and actually to the players or the kids' detriment. That being said, from what I've heard from Lonzo and the comments he's made about his father, I think he has a really good perspective on how to handle it all. Basically, he said, you know, I've lived with my father my whole life. That's just who he is. I've heard him talk my whole life. I let him do the talking and I do the playing.
I think that Papa Ball is over the top. There's no question about that. But on the other hand, maybe he's just demonstrating that he's learned from the adventures of Muhammad Ali back when he was still Cassius Clay and lesser self-promoters. Because what Ali taught us is if you say, I'm the greatest and it's going to be huge often enough, whether or not it's true, people are going to begin to believe it. And there's a certain degree to which the sizzle is at least as important in our world as the steak is, and maybe dad is just creating as much possible sizzle.
Especially in this social media-dominated world, I mean, I think people have loved to get into a back and forth about whether LaVar is good or bad for his son. But I have a question for you, Michael. I'm wondering, what kind of impact do you think this has, one, on teams who might be looking to draft Lonzo, and two, once he starts playing in the league, do you think players are going to go after him? I mean, I'm curious about what that first matchup with Steph Curry is going to be like.
Yeah, that could be a drawback, but I think the talent with him is something that if you're drafting him, you can kind of overlook the dad to some respect. I think NBA players are definitely aware of Lonzo Ball. They're definitely aware of his dad, and they know that right now his dad is writing a massive check that his son's going to have to cash. And it could work out in his favor because it may be what motivates him to go out there and get better and compete. But I know for a fact that he's going to come in with a huge target. But he's done well so far in college, and I'm sure guys want to go after him on that level as well.
All right, it's my turn. This week, ESPN's Howard Bryant concluded a story about the World Baseball Classic with these words, and I'm quoting now, "If baseball doesn't want to be swept into oblivion, its biggest stars need to be where the lights are brightest." He was referring to the absence of Clayton Kershaw, Bryce Harper, and Mike Trout from Team USA in that World Baseball Classic. I think swept into oblivion might be a little over the top, but I really like his sentiment. I wish the World Baseball Classic did draw the MVPs and the Cy Young Award winners. It'd be great for the game. It'd be better for the competition. And the teams that are sending their best players would have a better way to measure how successful and how good those players really are as baseball comes along in those countries. And plus, it's good fun. Hey, a real world champion emerges from this as opposed to the champion of North America. Michael, do you wish to disagree with me?
I wish to disagree with you, primarily because baseball is such an American pastime that I just don't know if American baseball fans will even care about what's happening, no matter who plays. I think it'll be ignored. I mean, there was a time when A-Rod played And I don't think anyone cared about the World Baseball Classic. I think that, you know, it's such a regional game. You can look at the local ratings for baseball. You know, fans get behind their teams and their local teams. They don't care about what goes on nationally. So you try to turn that to international baseball, I just don't think that fans will connect no matter who plays.
You know what? I was siding with you, Bill, and then I think Michael may have convinced me to look at it the other way.
It's not the first time that I've been one against two in this particular context. That's all right.
But you know what? It's important to speak to a larger point, which is that Major League Baseball can do a better job of promoting its stars and recognizing that it's through the stars that fans, particularly young fans, connect with their teams. And I think if you want to get that younger generation of fans into the fold, you've got to start doing more with individual players.
You know, Mike Trout is the best player in baseball, without a doubt.
Mm-hmm.
But I bet you Mike Trout could walk into just about any place wearing a Mike Trout shirt and a Mike Trout hat, and fans wouldn't know who he is because baseball doesn't do a great job of promoting its stars. But if they did, and Mike Trout played in the World Baseball Classic, maybe that'll help. But I think you got to really do a better job of having fans connect to these guys. I love Mike Trout playing. I love watching him play. He's fun to watch, but most fans don't even know what he looks like. They couldn't pick him out of a lineup.
I think it's fascinating that my topic, which was supposed to be about competition, has ended up being about marketing, because so much is about marketing in this wonderful world in which we live.
Whether it's hijabs or whether it's individual baseball players.
Doesn't seem to matter.
Or young college basketball players.
Yes, yes.
My guests for this week's Three Stories You Should Know have been Michael Lee of Yahoo Sports and WBUR's own Shira Springer, who also contributes to the Boston Globe. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having
me. Thank you.
Japan held its first international basketball tournament in 1917. That's right, 1917. Over the past century, the sport has had its ups and downs in that country, and Japanese clubs, like those in lots of countries, turn to American players to boost their popularity. And American players go, many to extend careers that would otherwise end. But our next story isn't about a guy who's playing in Japan just so that he can keep playing. Ira Brown, formerly of Corsicana, Texas, is playing in Japan because he's finally found a home. Abigail Leonard has the story.
It's game night in downtown Tokyo. This is the first season of Japan's latest premier basketball league, so many of the people filling the stands have never seen a game before. The home team, the Shibuya Sunrockers, is hoping to win over the crowd by putting on a show. Forward Ira Brown, a 34-year-old American, gets things started.
Brown just dunked over the heads of a whole bunch of other players.
On their next possession, Brown feeds the ball to a teammate for another 2 points.
Assist Ira!
Tokyo is maybe not where you'd expect a 6'4 broad-shouldered black guy from Texas to end up. But the style of play in Japan is part of why Ira Brown is here.
There are a lot of NBA players that come over here and try to be more ball dominant because of course, in the States, that's what you have to be. But here in Japan, it's like, it's not necessary. They simply want you to be a good team player.
Do you like that feeling more than the ball dominant feeling you were describing?
Oh, I love that feeling because with me, mostly it's like family oriented. I feel like if the team succeeds, I succeed.
Being part of a strong, stable family is important to Brown. He didn't have that growing up back in Corsicana, Texas.
The adults of our family, they were on drugs and or they were out in just running the streets pretty much. And my mom and dad were on drugs really bad. You walk in and see your mom doing crack or catching your dad doing it or whatever. Like, the living situations was kind of like, okay, you either sleep on the floor or you sleep on top of clothing or you sleep on top of wherever you can possibly sleep is where we slept.
Brown said they didn't have running water to do laundry or take showers. So at school, he and his cousins got teased for smelling bad. They were called Dirty Brown and were always getting in fights.
Did you ever feel sort of hopeless being in that kind of situation?
Well, in all honesty, I felt hopeless, but I knew that it's either to continue to be poor or to continue to smell bad or continue to do all these things or just simply do something about it. Like, I'd borrow the lawnmower and go mow lawns and stuff in order to get money. and we picked up pecans in sacks, and we'd go sell the pecans or whatever to the local pecan factory or whatever. So it's like there was always ways in which I wanted to earn money and earn it the honest way.
Things finally reached a breaking point when Brown was 9, living in a house on the east side of town.
We had quite a few family members there, probably about 20, 25 family members in a 3-bedroom house.
One day, he and his cousins got in a rough fight with a family down the block.
And then that evening, they threw a cocktail bomb in our house and ended up burning our house down.
The family scattered. Brown went to live with his grandmother, a woman who knew something about overcoming adversity. She'd lost both legs to diabetes, but he says she still kept a positive attitude. And there were other inspiring adults, too, like Milton, Brown's math tutor.
He was pretty much my father figure, in which I looked up to visiting every single week. And, like, he had this really huge ring on his hand, and he always, like, let me play with it or whatever, let me put it on my finger. And it was like a championship ring of some sort. I don't remember exact.
Brown says that ring inspired him to dream big, and he pushed himself. He became a high school basketball and baseball star and was drafted in 2001 by the Kansas City Royals.
I was a starting pitcher first in my career, and then later in my career I was a reliever. Topped out at 97 miles per hour.
And after 5 years in the minors, he couldn't see a future in baseball. So he decided to go to college and play basketball instead. He chose Gonzaga University. The biggest draw was its warm community.
When I went there for my visit, I fell in love with the place. Everybody knew everybody, and it was just one big family.
And he made them proud, soaring over the competition with a 45.5-inch vertical.
Lob, Brown! Oh, my word! Look where he is!
Brown finally got that ring he'd dreamed of as a boy. Three of them, in fact.
I got the WCC championship 2 years in a row. And I got a Sweet 16 ring for basketball in the NCAA tournament.
After college, he played briefly in the NBA Development League, then went overseas to teams in Mexico, Argentina, the Philippines, and finally, Japan. Brown is happy here, riding the train into downtown Tokyo for games, alongside weary salarymen and dolled up Harajuku girls. But still, his childhood haunted him. He feared repeating his parents' sins, so he turned to his faith, went on a fast, and abstained from sex. It was tough, though.
I was like, God, like, this is hard for me. And so I was like, if you really want me to do this, then you would send me a wife.
Then, a few weeks later, at a friend's birthday party, he met Ayaka.
And we sat there on the couch and chatted for like 3 hours straight, and I was like, man, this is my wife. And so sure enough, we got married.
Ayaka provided the strong, stable family life he'd been seeking.
We're closer to her family to whereas we can take care of them. Because that's one thing I really, really admire about the Japanese culture is that they take care of their elderly.
So he resolved to fully commit to Japan by getting his citizenship. It wasn't easy. The application process took 2 years. And then there was a difficult language test.
At the bottom of it says, what's your hobby? So I put my hobby is like watching sumo, eating sushi, and going to the onsen. So I ended up passing the test. Yeah,
that's the right answer, yeah. I guess. Yeah. Oh, that is amazing! Wow.
Becoming a citizen has also helped Brown's basketball career. Rules limit the number of foreigners allowed on the court, but now he can play the whole game, a real advantage for his team. It also means he can play on the Japanese national team. Last year, he traveled to Iran for the regional championships. Next up, he hopes, the Tokyo Olympics. Japan is hoping to qualify an Olympic men's basketball team for the first time since 1976. As the sport improves, more kids here are starting to play, and they look to Brown for inspiration.
So the Sunwalkers are all lining up now in the middle of the court, taking a bow, thanking the fans for coming. So they bow to each side of the stadium, give a wave.
Then fans come courtside, and Brown runs down the line, giving them high fives and a wide smile. It's a long way from tiny Corsicana, Texas. But every summer, Brown still goes back, bringing kids there donated basketball shoes and a little bit of hope. What do you tell them about being hopeful? I mean, for kids who maybe have the same kind of childhood that you had.
Well, I just tell them, like, no matter the situation or circumstance, understand that, like, there is always something that you can do to succeed. Don't ever count yourself out because of the hand that you were dealt with.
For Only a Game, I'm Abigail Leonard in Tokyo.
Soon after graduating from college, Pete Strickland was invited to play professional basketball in Ireland. But when he arrived at Shannon Airport, nobody was there to greet him. And he thought,
this is as good a prank as my friends have ever played on me. These guys are good. My buddies are good.
That's just ahead on Only a Game. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. Okay, I want you to think a moment about the people you care about. Have they ever listened to a podcast? Do they even know that podcasts exist? All this month, we're asking our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. Do it in real life or on social media. And if they don't know how to download them, give them a quick lesson. You'll be opening up a new world for them. Tell us what you're recommending with the hashtag Trypod. That's hashtag TryPod, and thanks. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, after running a marathon in prison, a former inmate has found a community and a purpose on the outside. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Presidents of the United States wield a good deal of power, and they can intimidate when they wish to, as we well know. But even U.S. presidents need to be careful not to run afoul of FIFA, as President Trump has recently learned. Soccer's governing body is angry about his travel ban. Why is that?
This is the Godzilla versus Megalon of international grifting right here. Yeah, the travel ban, we have a new one now, is complicating matters, including the attempt to host the 2026 World Cup. Generally, the FIFA's biggest problem with that is if the check doesn't clear. Or if the brown paper bag containing the large bills leaks or gets, you know, lost. But here we have the current administration actually getting on the wrong side of a moral issue from FIFA.
All right. It's quiz time.
Okay.
I'm going to tell you the score of a particular game, and you tell me who was playing in it and why it was significant. You ready?
Yes.
6-1.
Actually, I know this one, Bill. You know why? Because just your mentioning it makes your head glow in wonderful rainbow colors.
Blue and red.
That is the comeback that Barcelona did against PSG in the Champions League.
No Champions League team had ever come back from a 4-0 deficit, and Barcelona did it, and they did it in the closing seconds. It was something.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen the tape, go to it immediately.
Now, does that get it to the
1/16?
Oh, the quarterfinals. We're moving right along here.
We're moving along. Come August, Williamsport, Pennsylvania will be seeing some really huge baseball players on the diamond during the Little League World Series. What's going on? Age controversies? They got human growth hormone there now?
No, the Cardinals and the Pirates are going to play a regular season game in Williamsport.
And the score is going to be 108
to
107. Well,
I assume they're moving the fences back.
This week, Dirk Nowitzki of the Dallas Mavericks became the first international player to reach the NBA's 30,000-point mark. He joins Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Michael Jordan, Wilt Chamberlain, Karl Malone, and Kobe Bryant as players who have done that. Congratulations to him.
Yeah, he is the absolute perfect example of why expanding the NBA's talent base to the rest of the world matters. And another piece of the final vindication of the idea of the original Dream Team.
Mr. Nowitzki's boss, Mark Cuban, who owns the Mavericks, noticed that Magic Johnson had taken charge of the L.A. Lakers, and we know that because this week Cuban said, quote, I hope Magic Johnson and Rob Pelinka go down as the worst GM-president combination in history. What a nice thing
but,
to say.
No, he goes on to say he hopes they live wonderful lives.
I know.
I'm assuming this is a mere business transaction that Mr. Cuban is dealing with. Rob Pelinka, by the way, if people don't remember, was one of the supporting players with the Fab Five at Michigan.
Oh.
And was, in fact, a very vital cog in them going to their second Final Four where they lost to North Carolina. He appears in the Fab Five documentary, and he's quite an interesting guy. So I hope he, contrary to Mark Cuban, I hope he succeeds.
Early this week, I saw an article titled, "A Radical Experiment at Madison Square Garden, Silence. And at first, I thought it was the Knicks trying to spin the fact that they'd played a game that nobody had showed up to see, but I guess that wasn't it.
No, they just, against the Golden State Warriors, they did away with all of what we have come to know and loathe as game presentation, which is basically all the loud noise, all the flashing lights, everything that makes you feel like you're sitting inside a pinball machine. Draymond Green of the Golden State Warriors, however, was completely flummoxed by it.
Oh, dear.
He hated it, didn't like it, said it wasn't part of the atmosphere we're used to playing in the NBA. You know, bad rock music and flashing lights is what you got to do to get your game face on.
All right. I kind of enjoyed that game we played a few minutes ago. Let's play it again.
Oh, no.
You fill in the names of the teams and tell me why this game mattered. The score was 100-44.
Well, obviously, the winning team was the University of Connecticut women, and the losing team was anybody else
in the universe of women's basketball.
No, in this case, the runner-up was South Florida.
And it was a conference championship
game.
Those were supposed to be close.
It was the American Athletic Conference Championship, and they are supposed to be close, but unfortunately, the UConn women, as we've pointed out, are not going to lose a game for 50 years.
That's right. They don't play close. The latest in the Oakland Raiders' on-again, off-again love affair with Las Vegas is that the romance is on again. They lost some funding. Now they got some more funding. Who's on the hook for this now?
Bank of America has stepped in to fill the $650 million gap that was left when Sheldon Adelson decided he would rather not be part of this thing. None of the Raiders seem to know where they're going to be playing. The closest parallel I can think of this is when the Houston Oilers moved to Tennessee before their stadium was ready, and they were practicing in Nashville and playing in Memphis. And Jeff Fisher was literally living in his office, which was a trailer at the practice field. We may wind up watching the Raiders pitching tents in the desert at this point.
At least one MLB team understands how seriously spring training should be taken, Charlie. When Leonis Martin turned 29 this week, his teammates arranged for a mariachi band to follow him around the complex in Arizona. I wonder what it would sound like if a fly ball hit one of those really big guitars.
I don't know, but I'm telling you, they followed him around the ballpark.
I love it.
They were in center field while he was playing. And God bless him, he went out and brought them out water and stuff so they wouldn't the dehydrated mariachi is not something you want to deal with. This is good for the Mariners. I attribute this completely to the effect of Joe Maddon on baseball.
And finally, Charlie, last weekend at the Brazil Open tennis tournament, some very good athletes got work as ball retrievers. And you can explain why I say ball retrievers, I suppose.
Yeah, they were shelter dogs. And who's a good dog? Who's going to get the ball? Who's going to get the ball? No, but the one problem I have, of course, is I don't want to be the guy who has to grab the ball and throw it up in the air to serve it after the dog has slobbered on it.
That's the first thing I thought of. Absolutely.
I see the 99-mile-an-hour serve coming at you in this cloud of slop. Dog spit.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Some people know exactly what they're going to do when they graduate from college, and some people don't. In 1979, Pete Strickland, future successful D1 basketball coach, was one of the latter.
So that year I returned home. I ended up teaching English at a local Catholic school in D.C. And then the next year, the Odyssey began.
Said Odyssey started one weekend while Strickland was visiting his girlfriend at the University of Pittsburgh, where he'd played college ball. He thought his organized hoops days had ended, but a former teammate, Wayne Williams, invited him to join a game. He couldn't have known that one of the people on the sideline was an overseas scout with recruiting on his mind.
So I went out, played, and a guy from Ireland saw both Wayne and I, and he wanted us to come over for two different clubs.
At that time, did you know there was professional basketball in Ireland?
I was not aware, no.
This is not surprising, as the business of basketball in Ireland was not entirely professional, at least by some standards.
They said, "Can you buy your own ticket? We'll reimburse you when you get there." I said, "Great." So I bought my own ticket, arrived, and they got caught in traffic from Cork to Shannon, and there was nobody there. And I thought, this is as good a prank as my friends have ever played on me. They made me buy a ticket to Ireland. Now I'm here. These guys are good. My buddies are good.
But it wasn't a prank. The Irish connection showed up. The Neptune Club would employ Strickland as a basketball player, and he hoped he'd be introduced to a new world.
And we go to an Italian restaurant to eat, and I'm in the midst of my teammates. And this is it. I'm going to be part of a community and part of a culture. I'm going to learn about it. Playing basketball, that's exciting too, of course, being paid for that. And I can't understand a word they're saying. It was English. It was just the cork version. It took me a while to get in the ear.
It must have been a short while. Strickland excelled on the court, and he enjoyed teaching his teammates how to play the game as he'd learned it at Dematha Catholic High School in Washington and at Pitt. And sometimes Strickland and the other U.S. player on the club, Gary Gardner, would teach basketball at local schools.
And we go up to Knocknaheeny School, which was at the top of Cork, great school in a troubled area. Sister greeted me. She was great. I said, well, we're ready to get going. I said, just show us the gym. Oh, she said, Peter, we don't have a gym. We have a all-purpose room. I said, oh, no, that's not a problem. That's not an issue at all. She ushers us in there. I said, well, just bring out the baskets and we'll get started. Oh, Peter, we don't have baskets. I said, that's, all right, well, hey, that's no problem. Just, you know, bring out the balls and we'll get rolling. Oh, of course, I knew what was coming in. We don't have any balls either. She said, I thought you were going to bring the balls. No, I didn't, but we'll get them going. So all we did was defensive stance and slides. Girls were excited to this day. And I think I've done some good teaching in my life, 33-year coaching career. It's still the best hour of teaching, Bill, that I've ever put forth.
Maybe it was inevitable that given that level of creativity, Pete Strickland would soon become the player coach at the Neptune Club. He was 23, and shortly thereafter he became a recruiter and basketball promoter. That happened when the Neptune Club decided to host an international basketball tournament featuring two teams from Cork. They felt they needed a team from the U.S. where basketball began, and Strickland said he thought he could scare one up.
Yeah, I started calling my friends and said, look, we got to get a team together. And you guys, here's what we got. You can come over. Everything's paid for. Flight over and back. Oh, Pete, that's great. Can't wait.
Strickland and the Neptune Club billed those who showed up as the Maryland All-Stars. They weren't from Maryland. Some of them may have been All-Stars somewhere, but they'd never played together. Their publicity material featured photos of John Havlicek and Jerry West, because who was going to know?
We wouldn't have known that.
John Cooney played for the Cork Blue Demons. He remembers the Maryland All-Stars as American.
I would suggest that, yes, they were a decent team, but some of the Americans that had been coming over for years were better players than some of the lads out of Maryland All-Stars.
Still, those AirSats All-Stars were greeted enthusiastically by basketball fans in Cork. They marched in the town's St. Patrick's Day parade, following behind a hoop mounted on the back of a truck, shooting baskets along the route. Everybody remembers it as a heck of a show. And in the tournament's early going, the Maryland All-Stars lived up to their billing, minus the Hall of Famers in their promotional material. After their first two games, they were 2-0. Pete Strickland didn't get to play with the All-Stars. He was still on the Neptune roster.
And then it came down to the ultimate game of pool play, where the American All-Stars were supposed to play Blue Demons, which is our hated rival. I mean, take your Hatfields and McCoys and multiply by 10. Blue Demons and Neptune do not like each other.
Under normal circumstances, Strickland shouldn't have had to worry. But the Maryland All-Stars were playing with a depleted roster, in part because they'd been partying at an abnormal rate since arriving in Cork. And John Cooney of the Blue Demons liked his club's chances for this game that had captured the imagination of Cork's fans.
The atmosphere was electric. The actual gymnasium was full. It was an old gym, right? It was the only gym we had, but there were these big steel rafters, right? And the crowds, even we had people hanging from the rafters. It was unreal.
The game was all the Irish fans could have hoped for. Physical at times, close all the way, and in doubt as the clock ran down with the Maryland All-Stars up a measly point.
There was 2 seconds only left. 2 seconds. There was a jump ball. Our lad that was jumping was only about 6'3", but he couldn't jump an inch off the ground. Their guy was about 6'6". The Maryland All-Stars set up to defend their basket, so they were expecting to win the jump. But our fella won the jump, passed it back to me, and I just had time to catch the ball and shoot it. And nothing but net. Game over. buzzer went off and the crowds went mad. They just ran out of their seats in all over the court. It was crazy, crazy stuff.
Now, my understanding is that you have not had to pay for a drink since.
I wish that was the case, yeah. But I have to say, I got plenty of Guinness after that, all right. I was a toast of the town for a while.
The shot that Cooney drained delighted the Irish fans, but it unsettled Neptune Club player coach and Maryland All-Star recruiter Pete Strickland.
I mean, the Yanks don't even make the semis, Bill. I mean, it's a total disaster. We're going to have a pretty dead semis and a pretty dead final. Not only is the gym going to be empty, but our heated rivals are the ones that beat them. Well, we forget, of course, in the emotion of the moment, that our heated rivals have fans, too. The semis are sold out because this is the team that beat the Yanks, and the finals are sold out, and it's a huge success. So, you know what? Just like we drew it up.
Pete Strickland spent part of another season in Ireland as player-coach of the Neptune Club. Since then, he's run summer basketball camps in the country from time to time and stayed in touch with the game there as he coached at various colleges in the U.S. Unhappily, Irish basketball during those years was, well, according to former Blue Demon and heroic shotmaker John Cooney, not so good.
It really hit a slump for years there now, you know.
Indeed. It was a slump so deep that the national team ceased to exist, and most of the youth teams that remained were underfinanced and no longer competitive. So somebody had to save basketball on the island. Wouldn't it be great if Pete Strickland, the guy who'd built such enthusiasm for the game 37 years earlier, had wrapped up his college coaching career in the U.S. and had watched his son play his final college game? What if he was open to the idea that he ought to come back? Why not give him a call?
Pete, would you be interested? I said, yeah, I would be interested now. I would. I applied and I got the job.
John Cooney is good with the hire.
He was a fantastic player, but a great coach. And I'm sure he'll help bring on these guys because there are a few very good 17, 18-year-olds here who with good coach and I'm sure will come on in leaps and bounds.
As John Cooney sees it, leaps and bounds and defense and three-pointers might eventually get the Irish national team to international respectability. And Pete Strickland's the fellow who can make it happen.
Please God, he can, yeah, yeah. And we might all get to the Olympics someday.
It might seem like a stretch, but hey, if the Irish club needs inspiration, Pete Strickland can tell him about the day when under those rafters from which the fans hung, he saw the lightly regarded Blue Demons of the city of Cork knock off John Havlicek, Jerry West, and the rest of the Maryland All-Stars. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our intern is Ryan Fitzgerald. Our final word comes from Pete Strickland, who remembers what it was like to receive his first paycheck as a professional basketball player.
This is it. My dream come true. I'm getting paid to play basketball. And I saved that check for about 4 days when I needed to cash it to eat.
Hey, guys, I cashed the Neptune Club check. Ramen noodles and saltine crackers all around. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports, NPR style, on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.